Welcome to Small World, Big Problems, a podcast from the Philip Merrill Center of Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Luke Lytle, and today I'm having a discussion with Dr. Ursula Wilder. Dr. Wilder is a clinical psychologist at the Central Intelligence Agency, where she served for 27 years. She's done operational work with the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, analyzed the psychology of extremists in the DNI's Counterterrorism Center, and has spent considerable time assessing the psychology of world leaders for CIA. We discuss the importance of understanding the psychology of foreign leaders and of ourselves, the psychology of historical figures, and the psychology of deterrence. Dr. Wilder takes us down her career path and offers invaluable advice to students and young professionals in the national security space. We explore the frontiers of the study of psychology as applied to intelligence work, such as the fields of cyber psychology and artificial intelligence. We really run the gambit with this conversation, and I promise every minute is worth listening to. She joins us in person at the new Johns Hopkins Bloomberg Center for one of the most fascinating conversations I've ever had the pleasure to participate in, and I really hope you find it as exciting and stimulating as I did. Dr. Wilder, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a privilege to be here. It's nice.
So we'll start with the baseline for our listeners. What is your role in the organization of which you're a part at CIA?
So at present, I'm in the last 4 months of my career at CIA. So I'm entering retirement. So it's an exciting time and kind of a poignant one. But my current and final role is developing an advanced postgraduate training program for the newer psychologists who are coming in that already have professional experience in the community. They have experience at the agency, but there are certain specific areas of psychology that are useful to a career, very useful, and probably a better way to put it is necessary. And so I'm developing this advanced curriculum that would go on for 3 or 4 years that a psychologist who's been a while at the agency can then focus more on specific areas that are very germane to working in the intelligence community. So I'm designing that. It's great fun. And I am pulling up all my memories, what was useful, what wasn't. I'm talking to my colleagues. So that's what I'm doing. And then briefly summarizing, starting going backwards in my career from now to the early days, I completed, before I started this project, a deputy director of CIA fellowship looking at the implications of neurotechnology and cyber psychology on the intelligence community. And so that was a deep dive into tech, and I found that really interesting. And then I was, before that, 10 years forward deployed to the Directorate of Analysis. So I spent a little bit of time in the Kent School Training Academy for analysts in the Directorate of Analysis. I was a school psychologist, he's called me that. And then after that, close to 7 years doing psychological assessment of world leaders, although I've been doing remote psychological assessments my whole career, but this was focused on world leaders, which is great fun. Mm-hmm. And then a fellowship at the Brookings Institution, where I studied the psychological challenges as well as the rewards of being an intelligence officer, particularly in the domain of counterterrorism. But because it's a hard domain given the content, but it's also relevant to anybody who is in the work. So that was it. That was at Brookings. And then before that, 8 years of field work right after 9/11. So I traveled the world. I said I was posted to United Airlines. Fortunately, in those days, we could fly business class and long trips. And I met with agents around the world who were embedded in very dangerous context and difficult context. And it was great training on the psychology of terrorism because they had become experts on that. Mm-hmm. So I did that for 8 years. And then a 4-year stint before that in counterintelligence, spy catching. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure I was going to like that. That was early in my career, but I really did enjoy it. And there was a forensic aspect to it, law enforcement, which was an eye-opener for me and made me wonder if I should have joined the FBI. But I'm glad I didn't. I'm glad I did what I did. And then I should note that before becoming a CIA officer, I was a spouse for a decade with my husband now, 40 years. He was CIA a decade before I joined up. and we spent some time overseas, and that was a very good experience for me in terms of understanding the whole family side of things. I was a bit of an attitudinal spouse, and so when I became a psychologist for the agency, whenever there was some, shall we say, a determined spouse who wasn't sure, she wanted to give her employer, her husband's employer or spouse's employer, all of her data, they would assign her to me. So that is kind of gives you a sense of the sweep of my experience and intelligence.
Mm. Your career runs the gamut, you know, for operational assignments, educational assignments, all kinds of different locations. Many of our listeners are students and young professionals in the national security space, looking for jobs in the intelligence community, in DOD, or just the government in general. And so as they're navigating their careers and their educations, can you give us some idea of how you found yourself initially in this line of work? How did you get into psychology and or intelligence? And what was the order that you got into those?
Sure. So after graduate school, I had a completely different plan for myself. I graduated in 1992 with a PhD in clinical psychology. I had a few more steps to take before getting a license, as we all do. But I thought I was going to enter an academic career. So I was all ready to do that. But then we went overseas, as I said. And I didn't know all of my husband's colleagues, obviously. I obtained a position at the University of Hong Kong, kind of launching my academic career. But then some life events happened. When I was 9 months pregnant with our now grown-up son, I walked into a robbery of our quarters. The thieves ran out the back, thank goodness. But I made a phone call. I was shaken. And within 5 minutes, people that I knew who also lived in the building were in the quarters. And it was nonstop, taking me out to lunch. The management came twice a week just after work to check in with me, with us. They fanned my husband's colleagues through the city to find him. And so everybody was running wherever he might be, and they swept him up and brought him to me as quickly as they could. It was very touching and impressive. And they fended the local police off. They kind of created this wall around me. I kind of knew what was going on, but remember, I didn't know. This is what I know now. They sent a psychologist to speak with me repetitively. They sent the medical officer to speak with me, and I just liked that. And then the baby was born, and 2 weeks later, I was nursing the baby at home. It was Chinese New Year, and I start hearing I thought were firecrackers. Firecrackers early in the morning, and I see holes appearing in my windows, and somebody who was shooting at me with an air rifle, a mentally disturbed person in the high rise right next to me. So I hit the deck. And I kind of duck walk. My little baby's like happily eating the whole time. I got to the phone. I called the Marines. I could hear them kind of coming up the hill. And again, within 5 minutes, the apartment was full of people that I knew. And I thought, well, this is kind of impressive. And they asked me if I wanted to apply. I said yes, and the rest is history. I knew I liked the people. I knew I liked their attitude. Uh-huh. And so that's how I joined up. And I would say to those interested in joining governance and national security that what should draw you, in addition to the mission and patriotism, love of country, what should draw you most is the people. I could say that now that I'm close to the end of my career, because you spend 8 hours a day, usually more, 12 hours a day with these people. And it's really worth it. It's really worth it to spend time with people who are like that in every way. So we are really ordinary people at CIA, but occasionally we're reminded that we're working in what could be a Hollywood movie, except you can't make a movie out of what we do because no one would believe the plot. Okay, so, and it's the same that way with our intelligence community, sisters and brothers. So that's how I got to where I am now, I guess.
Yeah, that really resonates with me. My career so far in the Army, it's the same thing. It's the people who are around you. You find yourself in this remarkable situation, but then you look around and these are just ordinary people that you work with, right? but you're undertaking these extraordinary feats. It's a cool moment.
You see, they're ordinary, but there are also people who serve, which you have chosen to serve. So may I quickly ask, where are you in the Army?
So I'm a military intelligence officer right now. And I started, you know, here in the U.S. training. I've been to Colorado,
Georgia, from Colorado. I deployed to Kosovo and was part of the KFOR mission there in 2018. And did mostly.
What an experience that must have been.
It was remarkable. It was a great mission, great deployment, peacekeeping, you know, primarily liaising, speaking with local government leaders and officials, keeping our hands on the pulse of the population and making sure that we knew what their concerns were. And then that was my first operational deployment. Went to Fort Drum, New York, and worked there for a while. And from there, I deployed to Syria in 2022 and was part of the mission there. That was a great experience.
I can well imagine. Mm-hmm. I can imagine that. Well, your history is an example of the kind of people you work with, and you're still young. Mm-hmm. So anyone listening to this can hear what it's like to just encounter people mm-hmm. like you, like two of us in this career area. So mm-hmm. and already you have had adventures and major ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And hopefully, served in major ways.
Yeah. Well, and hopefully many more to come. And I didn't know I was going to go to any of these places when I joined. I don't think anyone really does.
You don't.
Right. But the places you go just blow your mind and what you're exposed to. So I second the opinion. I think it's well worth joining. And I think there's so much more to it, and it's so much more rewarding than, you know, just the job, people, the experiences. There's so much to it.
It's a very good way to spend your career. Absolutely. I can say that at the end.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You've spent, you know, most of your career in the intelligence community. Mm-hmm. What was the appeal to you of applying your psychological expertise to intelligence work specifically?
Well, in the beginning, I was interested. I thought I was going to just be working with a very interesting group of people. As a clinical psychologist, I was going to work with employees in basic medical care. Remember, they said the psychologists to see me repetitively. I thought I'd be doing that. That's, and of course, as you heard, it's been very different from that. But I also traveled a lot, grew up overseas, and I had a great love of country. I love our country. I think the American people are worthy, good people to give your career to. And obviously, the Constitution is magnificent work of politics, and other people feel the same way about their own countries and nations. But this is my nation, and I wanted to serve. I just thought this is a worthy place to spend 30 years, 25 years of my life. But also, as a psychologist, I have to tell you that all the writers of fiction will tell you, like Jean Le Carré said this and others, that the intelligence services of a nation are an expression of their, what I would use a term, the unconscious, collective unconscious, to use a Jungian term. Mm-hmm. It's where all the secrets reside of that nation. It's the now others would say the id, the negative impulses, but it's far more than that. But it's where the true nature of the cultural personality resides. And so to be in the middle of that as a psychologist, as you might imagine, was, and to be now, of course, since once you become part of it, you become biased, but that's neither here nor there. It was a very appealing, and it has indeed been that way, because dire things do happen, things that shouldn't happen. But most of it is just, as you and I have just discussed, really decent, amazing people channeling their creativity and their deepest desires, even if they're not conscious of it, into doing good. And in our intelligence services, that's not the public presentation always. But so that's what drew me. And of course, we collaborate in this domain with our military psychologist colleagues. And so that was something I hadn't anticipated, but that I enjoyed the FBI, as I said, law enforcement, DHS, all the three-letter NSA, worked with all of them. So that was the appeal.
That's fascinating. The intelligence community is the nation's unconscious. I never thought of it that way.
It's where the secrets reside.
Right.
And because so much happens in secret, so much that is good is hidden, and so much that is bad is hidden. That's the nature of the unconscious. And the people on the inside of it aren't necessarily conscious of that. Mm. You're not conscious of the unconscious. Mm-hmm. So if you want to see really good, decent people kind of engaged in something that is truly unique, then this is the way to do it. It's why the spy genre is so utterly popular, because people want to look in.
Well, definitely. So. So we'll let's transition over to the technical side of what you do.
Right.
So why do you think it's important for policymakers and decision makers to integrate leader psychological assessments into their analysis and into their planning?
So again, I'll answer that on two levels. Okay. The first is on a formal level. It is helpful, very helpful to our customers, let's just call them customers, to have an understanding of the personality of the person that they're either their opponent. Didn't Clausewitz say that? He took everything from scientific battle into no, you got to know your opponent, right? Yep. And
he ends on to both huge emphasis on understanding your opponent, understanding your enemy.
So meet Clausewitz, I say. Ask Lucas about it because he clearly understands that better than I do. But I did read sections. It's like, yeah, this guy nailed, you know, how the fog of battle, and part of the fog is how the other person's responding. So knowing the personality of the other leader is useful in encounters, in negotiations, kind of in managing international crises, all the rest. Mm-hmm. In terms of engagements one-on-one with another leader, sometimes what's really useful is knowing what not to do wrong. So let me give you a concrete example. If you have a leader that's fairly untrusting, maybe even paranoid, engaging with that person on an emotional level, trying to engage their softer feelings will make them very more untrusting, and they will feel insulted because that's not how they see the world, and their inner dialogue will be, well, you think I'm weak, okay? But on the other hand, if you have a leader who likes to connect and needs that fellow feeling, if you don't enable that to happen and it becomes all transactional, then that person will see you as someone they can't trust because you don't have the feelings that would inspire values and that would inspire keeping to the agreements you make. So knowing what you're dealing with is really, really helpful to engagements remotely if we're trying to work out how a person's going to respond. Personality can be very helpful. And you can't ever predict behavior, although the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. And that's not just how they behave in ways that are visible, but internal behavior like thinking, meditating, ruminating, obsessing, having sadistic thoughts, whatever we can determine from the external behavior that we've seen. So that's technically why it's useful. And on a more casual level, of course, the customers are power people themselves. So they're curious. Okay. I mean, I would be curious about a neutral assessment of psychologists in the intelligence community. It's like, it's me. Yeah. You probably would feel the same way.
Absolutely.
So they're eager to look into that group of people because it's their tribe, even if they're enemies. And so you can have some really interesting discussions with them. And once, if they trust you, meaning the psychologist, they'll start telling you things that are really useful, that they've observed but haven't made it into the record because it doesn't seem relevant. So that's the other reason why you do it. Customers love it. Mm.
And are there certain contexts or situations when these leaders or policymakers most often look for your work? They most likely seek psychological assessments or others.
It's when there's an upcoming encounter. Mm-hmm. So there's that. When an encounter that happened did not go well, when unexpectedly, there's that. Okay, you were doing this kind of work in Kosovo, mm-hmm. right, taking the temperature. Mm-hmm. And the other time is when there is a major international crisis and you want to evaluate how all the different parties are responding to it. So let's use the example of Kosovo. There was so much trauma of the current leadership generation. That has got to be folded in when you're thinking about violence and war. We Neville Chamberlain is often seen as this awful peacekeeper, right? Peace in our time. So that in a time of crisis, it can be very helpful, but you just have to be focused on who you're assessing because we can't do them all. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you don't do no, none of them well. Mm-hmm. To pick the ones you want to look at.
Yeah, that was definitely my experience in Kosovo when you, because I served some time down in the southern area where it's mostly Albanian, and then I served for a while up in the northern area where it's mostly Serbian, and you get to know them and see both sides and learn about the conflict from their perspectives. That was a fascinating exercise in perspective, for sure. And you see how it influences what they do and their thoughts, obviously.
That's the context part. So if you and I were working together, you would be telling me all of that and what you know about the individual. And then I would start kind of trying to figure out the personality, and together we'd come to an understanding, and then you'd go brief into the military.
So this question, I think, would be really interesting to younger professionals and people who are going into the field. Looking at how we can expand maybe the field, is there a certain situation or problem set for you for which you think psychological analysis could be used more in a policymaking context, in a government context? Where are there opportunities, particularly lower in the chain of command, where they can apply psychological tools or psychologists to help with their problems?
It's interesting that you should ask me that, because that's my final project, both what core arenas like personality, psychopathology, specific ones like paranoia, which is the political disease, narcissism, sadism, that pop up a lot inside of threat issues that will always be there, but also anticipating what psychological areas of expertise the newer psychologists will need to develop. And so that I can use all of that research I've been doing to answer these questions. So you think about it on two levels. Again, there's, and you would know this as a military intelligence officer, there's always the, what do we need to study that our targets are doing in this arena? Their behavior, their plans, their strategy. Okay, so what psychological arenas are they developing in? And then there's this next question, which is, what do we need to develop? What tools do we need to develop to enable our mission? And then a subcategory of that, which usually gets neglected, but it's worth thinking about, is how is this work affecting the people who are doing it? Okay. And because if we're getting affected by the work, it's good to know that, for better as well as for worse.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, and those who get affected most to a degree are the newer officers, because they're learning the culture, they're learning, you know, their professional set, their professional identity, if you want to put it that way. So in my domain, the three areas that I've carved out that would be new would be cyber psychology. It's I won't even go into the nuances of that. I know you have a cyber focus here at SAIS, but cyber psychology is just in its infancy. And yet there is so much happening, both in terms of what people are doing to themselves and how they're manipulating, or their brains are being manipulated by all sorts of technologies. So cyber psychology is something that we're going to have to dig more deeply into. I'll give you a quick example of that. If somebody is engaging in violently antisocial sadistic acts online and play, and yet the rest of their life is flat and fine, what does that mean? Okay. We've already determined that if it has to do with juveniles, no. But, you know, it's a, but it's all make-believe, right?
Right, right?
So that's just one example, okay? The other arena that we need to look at is space technology. Right now, I'll give you what it's going to mean in terms of existential questions, what it's going to mean in terms of how it affects other cultures when they face our existential issues. And I'm talking not just about warfare. I'm talking about deep space exploration and all the rest. And that's going to be the next 30 years. Of course, so much has been done about space travel, but it's a minor compared to what we're thinking about, which is kind of hilarious when you think of what it took to get to the moon, et cetera. So right now, for example, NASA has a program called SHARP, in part, but part of the program where they're looking at the genetics that we still carry from our reptilian ancestors who crawled out of the primordial ooze, who could hibernate. What they want to see is if you can safely get a deep space astronaut into what they call torpor, which is hibernation, because you simply can't put needles in them. There are many reasons why you can't drug them. They won't survive, but neither can you go into deep space exploration with 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 logistical ships behind you with food and oxygen and all the rest. Again, you're military, so you can explain that mm-hmm. well to the audience. Mm-hmm. So now, you can, if you could shift the genetic code of deep space explorers to make them able to enter torpor and also more radiation immune, mm-hmm. okay, like lizards, lizard people again. Really, implications of that?
Yeah.
Okay. In terms of what are you going to make ensure that they don't get married and reproduce? These are human beings,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Are you going to? I mean, there are so many implications about that. And when you're in torpor, you're missing years of your life. So we need to know that that's what NASA is doing. But if this kind of thing is happening and other countries are doing it, we need also to think about where their ethics are pushing them. And I think they have ethics. It might just be different from ours. And last is easy and hard at the same time. It's physical pandemics and cyber warfare. And I lump those two together because this is when the world around you has collapsed. So we recently saw in CloudStrike an example of how the system that we all rely on temporarily, thank goodness, shut down. But hospitals, schools, this just to explain this for your listeners, CloudStrike was an update that shut down many of the systems worldwide. Mm-hmm. You can look it up.
Yeah.
There's lots of information on it. I just so that your listeners can they probably can if it's mm-hmm. your listeners, but not everybody can follow that. And the reason why I put these things together is what happens is human beings in a pandemic and in something like cyber warfare or a shutdown are shut down. Mm-hmm. They're locked in. And we have to know how to continue to function.
Yeah.
We also have to predict how other nations are going to function in this one arena of pandemics and cyber warfare.
Yeah. Well, not only shut in, but also feeling a profound sense of loss of control. You can't control the update. You can't control the pandemic. There's nothing you can do about that.
How are you going to get food? How are you going to get medicines? Your spouse is expecting. Who's going to deliver the baby? Do you go into work? The security system isn't working at work. Who's going to be let in? Who isn't? Mm-hmm. So anyway, that is just a minor example, but make that bigger and bigger and bigger every part of your life. So those are the three arenas I would say that we have very little knowledge and we're going to need them, either in a crisis or just in general.
Yeah, vast frontiers, you know, literally and figuratively mm-hmm. to explore.
Yeah.
So we'll switch to the past. And this is a subject that I'm particularly fascinated in, and I know that you've spent a lot of time studying, and that's historical figures. So that's part of the job. Which historical figures have you found the most fascinating to analyze from a psychological perspective?
So overall, every personality is interesting to a psychologist, even if it's as flat as can be. Okay, the most boring person is boring for a reason. And it's just interesting to figure that out. There might be like volcanic levels of meaning going on in there, or they might be so damaged by awful things that happen to them. And that's a tragedy to see that. But it's still, it's like watching Macbeth, which is about collapse of a personality. It's interesting and fascinating, very sad when that's the case. Historical leaders remind all of us, remind me that psychology's always been there, just by a different name. Homer was a great psychologist. Mm-hmm. Or the Homeric authors, if you want to be technical,
sure.
because yeah. you know, they some say that it was a group authored epic. I have my thoughts on that, but that's mm-hmm. not psychology. That's me getting literary and geeking out a bit here. Mm-hmm. So historical leaders inform what has not changed in leadership in the current era. And that's really helpful to know. But also when there are things that the current era of history are driving, it lets you know that too. And it helps you put in perspective all the different parts that you're looking at in terms of the individual leader. Although this is my view, and some would disagree, okay? By now, you've probably figured I'm a depth psychologist. I like going into the unconscious. Mm-hmm. Behaviorists would say, well, you know, there's no science behind that. Let's just stick with behavior. And ironically, I've had to become a behaviorist because you can't psychoanalyze in person a leader. So you have to look at their behavior and try to trace it back.
Sure.
You really need both. But if you read what Julius Caesar wrote, this beautiful, lucid, propagandistic classics Grant wrote, you know, it's you can get bits of their psyche unedited. So I always started with the greats. Okay, so Genghis Khan means oceanic. Okay, so the oceanic leader, right? So that, and then there's Catherine the Great. And then there's Catherine, the great grandfather-in-law, the grandfather of her husband. And so that would be Peter the Great. And then there's Friedrich the Great. So you kind of go to these greats where you can actually have current data on them and you learn a lot. Mm-hmm. And then there's the one main leaders, Napoleon, Caesar. Okay, we know who they are. Cleopatra, even the last pharaoh of Egypt. So I started there. I had to be careful because it's so distracting. As I told you before we started with the interview, and I can spend like 3 months on each one of them. It's like, stop. Just focus and move on. And there are elements that they all collectively share, okay, particularly on charisma and power, okay? But again, power is like money. People say, somebody wants money because they're greedy. No. What do they want the money for? That's what's interesting. And so, and each person is unique in themselves. And so that those leaders are a perpetual and forever gold mine to inform now. And then from there, you move on to the villains. Okay, so that would be the Hitlers of the world, Stalins, Mao, Pol Pot, you know, just you can name them. This is where humility and psychology is incredibly important. Because when you're dealing with the geniuses like Churchill, we will talk about that in a minute, or with the truly evil people, you are genuinely in the realm of evil. In terms like psychopathy and sadism, the terms that we use, malignant narcissism, don't work when you're talking about someone like Hitler. It just doesn't quite connect with the essence of who that person is. When I was doing the nonstop travel after 9/11, I obtained a master's in theological studies. I'd always been interested, and I studied in graduate school and for my dissertation, deviant, violent religious groups, which was why it was helpful to why I was engaged after 9/11. But I realized some of what I'm seeing here, just psychology can describe it, give you descriptive terms, but it doesn't capture the essence. So I got a theology degree. I thought, go to other wisdom traditions, and it was very helpful. And the core concept that struck me in the systematic theology class was that evil is quantitatively millions and millions dead. Okay, so quantitatively, but more significantly, qualitatively different than your average human malfeasance. Evil is both quantitatively, in terms of the massive nature of what it does, but more significantly, qualitatively different than human malfeasance. And that was extremely helpful because it puts limits on what I can achieve. If you try to pin down some of these personalities, you're going to not do that good of a job of understanding your limits. And you also have to understand why you can't really psychologically get your arms fully around someone like Hitler, so that when you're dealing with a person who's in a different value system, who might be thuggish. Alexander the Great is an example. We've all decided Alexander was thuggish. Well, if he was, every leader around him was too. You kind of have to be able to make those judgments, contextual judgments. But it begins by knowing, having a sense of who really is in that minor category of malevolence, okay, for want of a better term. So that is why I study the evil ones, although it's disturbing, there's only so much you can do with it, but I do that. And then there's the geniuses like Lincoln, inexplicable geniuses are just inexplicable, like Shakespeare. You know, how does a minor son of Glover, or somebody who made the luxury goods of gloves and the Renaissance, write what he wrote? Some of the military genius, you just can't pin it down. And they're interesting to know too, because you need to, every leader wants to be one. But, you know, someone said about Churchill at one point that he was annoying his colleagues, meaning the other aristocrats in Parliament. And came home, one of them came home and was complaining to his wife about Winston. And she said, well, what are you going to do about it? And he said, in a very nice upper crust British accent, okay, not how I just said it. And he said, you know, Winston is a genius. That lightning strike across the brain. You can't do anything other than to stand back and watch. And so it's important to know when you're dealing with that too, because that also is inexplicable. So that's why I dig into history. And it helps me with current leaders. The generals, who are also politicians, are a fascinating subset to me. The Napoleons, the Eisenhowers, yeah. Washington.
Yeah.
It's hard to make that transition. You can get stuck in MacArthur. Okay.
Or to live both simultaneously, or like some cases.
That is an interesting mind right there. Mm. But usually, by becoming generals and being selected for their functions as generals, they can do both. These ambidextrous minds, right? And this the science, military science side, mm-hmm. but also that human, charismatic side.
Yeah. Is there a danger of those two blending, though? Like the military and the political, they those two topics, which, you know, we hold should generally be separate, and the Kossuth would say that. But if they start to combine and get confused with each other.
If they combine but still remain somewhat of themselves, what you get is a charismatic realist, which is one step away from, you know, psychopath.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, if somebody's truly sticking with the realist approach, you'll have it's pure transaction. Okay, which to a degree, to protect the minds of the generals, is needed in the middle of battle. Because all the carnage, if they focused on that, how could they do what they need to do in that context? Mm-hmm. But if they believe it, okay, if they actually believe that that's okay and have the charisma to suck people into their orbit, then you have a very dangerous, and charisma is an unconscious process in a certain kind of way. So then you have a very dangerous person.
Okay.
So there are the inexplicable leaders who have no reason to be doing as well as they're doing. They're the ones who go down in history, and those are the genius leaders. And you study them, Lincolns of this world, and you study them carefully because, like the evil ones, they help you properly, if you will, diagnose what you're dealing with. And some things you just cannot fully grasp psychology. You have to go to other epistemologies, if you will, traditions. Now, in terms of how it feels to do this work as a psychologist, I found a wonderful passage from Machiavelli, which I hope you'll read for us. Mm-hmm. As I said earlier, you do not have to have a Renaissance Florentine accent to do this, but it's in a male voice, and it perfectly captures what it's like to do this work. He was in permanent exile in the countryside. He'd been tortured because he supported a republic, and the Medicis came back into power, and he never could make his way back into the power circles. So he spent his day in the countryside, in the town, helping on the farm. He spent some time in the house of ill repute downtown, so to speak, in this little village with his family. So there's a poignancy to this. But he was Machiavelli, speaking of geniuses, okay, and he wrote the first modern political treatise on leadership. And yet you can hear in this letter, as he had great correspondence with all of his former colleagues, one of them, by the way, was Da Vinci, just saying, on the military level, And this is a letter where he is describing his daily life. And I thought, go ahead and read it. It says it. It's Machiavelli. It says it better than I could say it.
Absolutely. On the coming of evening, I return to my house and enter my study. And at the door, I take off the day's clothing, covered with mud and dust, and put on garments regal and courtly, and reclothed appropriately, I enter the ancient courts of ancient men, where, received by them with affection, I feed on that food which is only mine and which I was born for, where I am not ashamed to speak with them and to ask them the reason for their actions. And they in their kindness answer me. And for 4 hours of time, I do not feel boredom. I forget every trouble. I do not dread poverty. I'm not frightened by death. Entirely, I give myself over to them. And because Dante says it does not produce knowledge when we hear but do not remember, I've noted everything in their conversation which has profited me, and have composed a little work on Principalities, the Prince, where I go as deeply as I can into considerations on this subject, debating what a princedom is, of what kinds they are, how they are gained, how they are kept, why they are lost.
So there, Lucas, you see that combination of the mind of the analyst, engineer, scientist, and the drive of the creator type, the emotion, the life experiences that have been so painful. When he says, I don't think of trouble, what he's talking about probably is his torture session. And not that analysts can torture it anymore, but just saying, so I think this is a wonderful description. How did you respond to it?
It's remarkably intimate. You know, I give myself over to them, just, and these people that he's never even met, just through a book, but yet he develops this intimate tie with them. I thought that was so, so remarkable. And I've never done deep psychological analysis, but that's probably as good a window as, you know, the average person is going to get into what it probably feels like to really dig deep into somebody's mind.
I bet you've read about a leader. Mm-hmm. I bet you've read about a military leader. Mm-hmm. Did this happen to you as you were reading their backgrounds?
A bit. Yeah, for sure. Not from a psychological perspective, but, you know, trying to get to know leaders that I've studied both in an operational perspective and here at SAIS, actually, through my studies. You know, we were at Clausewitz recently in class and trying to dig into his mind and understand where he got his ideas. That was really fascinating. And you do start to get to know the person a little bit, and you start to measure what their voice might have sounded like if they were talking, and what it was like around them while they were writing it. And that's definitely a fascinating thing. This passage is a great window into what that feels like at an even deeper level.
I have to tell you, sometimes I think it's a bit of a crime that I get paid to do this. It's just so wonderful to do. Yeah. So thank you for reading that.
No, absolutely. So let's look at the other side of this. Can you give us some examples of some organizations that fail to analyze and leverage intelligence effectively? And maybe, do you think the psychology of certain key leaders may have contributed to those failures?
So yes, there's so many examples of this, but I wanted to start with the 9/11 Commission report because they had a chapter titled Foresight and Hindsight. They were very humble about hindsight, how it's really easy to go backwards and see where all the mistakes were made. And we had to be careful not to assume that we know how those mistakes were made, and then foresight, how we can take what happened and try to prevent it from happening again. And they came up with these four categories, which I think are applicable to any failure of intelligence, whether it's military or political. These elements in it, and they are psychological. So the first is an imagination. It's almost become a cliche, but a failure in imagination means that the analyst has not been afforded the opportunity to just be open emotionally and psychologically to insight, to the kind of things that bubble up from when you're talking about Clausewitz. You're formally studying it, and yet you're also kind of feeling it at the same time. Mm. If you can't do that part, you're never going to be able to anticipate certain things that are going to come, like airplanes into buildings. Okay. And then in policy, okay, and so we are very obedient to policy. We need to be if we want to be ethical government servants. But that if the policy's off, that's it becomes a bit of a prison to what was supposed to be I'm free to do and capabilities. And that's the eternal problem. Think about it this way. There are only like a few. There's only one of me actually at times doing this and the whole world. So that's, remember earlier when I said we have to pick in a situation like when you were in Kosovo, you have to pick which ones you're going to focus on. But you might pick the wrong one. Yeah. Okay. And because there aren't the capabilities. And in management, everybody taking care of their rice bowl, so to speak, or you see this sometimes in medicine, my profession, you know, okay, I'm a cardiologist, your heart is fine. It's like, yeah, but you kind of miss the sepsis in the system, you know, so it applies everywhere, okay? Mm-hmm. So you'll find those incidents in these elements in every intelligence failure. And so examples that came to my mind were Pearl Harbor, okay? Now, this would be more your domain than mine. But both the Japanese and the U.S. made intelligence mistakes in completely different domains. Okay. The Bay of Pigs, of course. What a debacle. But it was a huge one. What the heck happened? Okay. Mm-hmm. There was groupthink. There was sunk cost. And we've already planned it. There was a transfer from Eisenhower to Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Completely different administrations. Mm-hmm. There was a new... the best and the brightest, you know, all from the Ivy League universities around Kennedy, swirling young, sure. Energetic, sure. We're just going to get rid of the old. And then Eisenhower representing that, of course, after that, Kennedy being Kennedy, went and had a consult with Eisenhower. That's what made Kennedy a great president. He said, how could we have been so stupid? He was talking about groupthink. And he went to Eisenhower. He realized that he had to go to this general politician and get some help. And then, of course, 9/11. You look back and it's like, how could we have not seen it? But we didn't. So those are classic examples of intelligent failures. There are others as well. But it always comes down to imagination, policy, capabilities, and management, and to different degrees, but they're all involved in the problems that arise. You know, we're doing this right now. It's just the nature of human beings. It's always an error rate.
Yeah.
So that's why we need an intelligence community so we can consult with each other and for being friendly with each other. And I mean,
right.
decided sure, over each other's, like yeah. happened in 9/11.
Right. In the Bay of Pigs invasion, too, I mean, that's a failure to understand the mindset of the population of the place you're going, right? Because they expected the locals to join the initial invasion and overthrow Castro's government. But that absolutely didn't happen. They just didn't. They failed to understand how the people in Cuba were thinking, where they were
going to respond. And that came from the fact that the only Cubans we were engaging with were Cuban Americans who wanted to liberate their culture, their nation, from communism. But there might have been a whole other group of Cubans who had different views.
Right.
And also, there wasn't the cohesion that was needed to... The capabilities were not sent that needed to be sent to support the invasion. And the whole concept of the invasion hadn't been considered before it started. It was just kind of business as usual. But the good news is the administration then, the Kennedy administration, did a better job with the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And so did the intelligence community.
That'd be a whole other window to explore yeah. the psychology of Cuban Missile Crisis and that Kennedy Khrushchev dynamic. We don't have to get into that here, obviously. That's a whole rabbit hole. But
well, it's worth talking about both of them together and what happened in the interim. On a psychological level, because I think Kennedy, I'm paraphrasing, this might not be the fully accurate quote, but something to the effect after CIA, less a stellar performance in the Bay of Pigs. So she said, I will destroy them and sow the earth with salt, okay? I'm glad he didn't do that because we were useful during the Bay of Pigs. But what happened in both institutions? The Oval Office, the White House, and the Central Intelligence Agency, military intelligence. I mean, all of the intelligence agencies that made what happened, the success that happened, in the Cuban Missile Crisis occur, were changes. And that's worth looking at, too.
Mm.
So but I had to be careful because I don't want to geek out too much and get take away from all the questions I know you want to ask
me. We love geeking out here at SICE.
I
share it. So to wrap this part up, are there any key lessons or common trends about political success or failure, military success or failure, that you've been able to take away from your studies of historic leaders?
The failures are easier, right, to understand. The successes are more difficult to understand, or to duplicate is a better way to put it. As a psychologist, I would say that what seems to stand out from the successes is the freedom of thought that exists in those that are dealing with the context in which the success is happening, that there is this unique combination of a strategy that's well thought out and not so much fungible as open, okay? And the tactics can change as needed in the moment. I like to say that I think Americans are particularly good at this. I mean, we are innovators, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. And an Italian ambassador to the United States was leaving. He was a beloved ambassador. And he was asked, what are you looking forward to about going back to Italy? Kind of standard question. And he said, I'm looking forward to returning to a culture where beauty is the highest value.
Really?
Which is true. Mm-hmm. And I was asked, what's the difference between Italy and the United States? A little edgier question. And his response was, well, in Italy, we innovate from tradition. We innovate from tradition, but in the United States, innovation is tradition. And I thought that was so smart and correct. So when you see these crises that or things that go well, it's usually because the innovation is still there. And the innovation does not come initially from thinking it through. It won't succeed if you don't think it through, but it comes from intuition. It comes from we could do this, and there needs to be room for that. And then you lock it down with some discipline and get rid of innovation that is going to be damaging. Mm-hmm. You don't, a thought might be great, but that doesn't mean it's going to work. So when I had the opportunity to look at abject failures in a minor scale, it's usually because people have been tight and locked down. And in the States, it's the best of us doesn't come out like that.
Absolutely. But so unfortunately, we need to move on to a different topic. Okay. This is so fascinating. This one is one that I'm particularly interested in and studying. A lot of people at SICE and in the national security community are studying, and that's deterrence. And I think there's a psychological aspect to it. It's a prominent, nebulous topic among national security scholars and officials right now. But at the end of the day, I think deterrence is a psychological endeavor in many ways. Would you comment on the extent to which psychology and our psychological evaluation should play a role as we make effective deterrence policy?
Now, I will admit that deterrence policy is not my forte, okay? Like, this is the first time I've actually thought about deterrence policy. So I will say something that might be completely basic that all of your listeners already know, but I will say it. I consulted with my husband and my son, who also has a graduate level degree in security policy. I said, okay, to explain deterrence, what the theory of deterrence is. And both of them said, you have to have two levels that are both credible for deterrence to work. The capacity to carry out, almost a hardware to carry out the threat, if we're using hard deterrence, okay, not soft deterrence, and the target of the deterrent must believe it is the will. Okay. And you need both in equal measure. So the work of psychology is assessing the will. Okay, what is it that gives a person the will to act in any place, let alone in the face of a deterrent? In weapons training, they tell us that you should never pick up a firearm unless you intend to use it. They're very clear. Make the decision before you take weapons training, because you don't want to be making that decision while you're holding the firearm or the weapon because somebody can come and take it away from you. Mm-hmm. Okay. And people around you might be assuming that you're willing to do this. And it's not a negative comment on people who can't shoot. Okay. Emotionally or ethically, it's just know who you are before you pick up the firearm. I think that's really interesting. And if you can have, you got the capability to be holding the firearm, but not the will to use it in the moment, then, you know, you're lost. And if the other person assesses that you don't have the will and it coming at you, then you're really lost. Mm-hmm. So that was an analogy from my life that kind of came to mind on this. It has been occasionally my job to assess a leader's willingness to act despite deterrent.
Yeah.
Or alternatively, to stand down in the face of a deterrent, or even occasionally to craft a deterrent that may or may not work. And it's really hard work, okay? It's difficult work to do. And it's easy to make mistakes in this arena, especially thinking, well, I wouldn't want that to be done to me. And so I would do this or that, projecting who we are onto the other. Mm-hmm. And that's both necessary because that's the basis of empathy, but also very dangerous if that's all you do. So it's work where you work with experts on the person, on the culture. So these are the kinds of questions that psychologists would ask about a leader when facing a deterrent or imposing one on us, okay? Mm-hmm. How does he or she view coercive military power or coercive power in general, mm-hmm. aimed at them,
yeah.
okay? How have they experienced violence and coercion? And I'm talking from the time they were born, okay? Saddam Hussein's mother rejected him at birth, wouldn't suckle him, okay? And he was drifting around the house, abused by her brother. He was sent away because she was so uninterested and maybe dangerous to him. And to an uncle, and there are some, he was very abusive, perhaps sexually. We don't have that clearly, but all the signs are there. And then he came back to the household, and another uncle, seeing his potential, Saddam wanted to be educated. It's so interesting. Lincoln wanted to be educated. Saddam wanted to be educated. There's this drive to get educated. And so he was educated, undereducated, but still educated. And then he became Saddam. Okay. If you know that kind of history of the person who you're thinking of imposing a deterrent or lifting a deterrent, it can give you some sense of how they're going to react to force, to coercion, either physical or otherwise. Somebody who hasn't had that experience probably isn't going to be in needing to be deterred, but nevertheless, it's going to be a different optic. You look at things like risk-taking. All leaders have to take risks, but is there ill-thought-out, impulsive, cat-in-the-hat kind of, the mom's gone, let's wreck the house kind of. Cat in hat, put it all back, which is not entirely believable, but nevertheless, you know, the book is driven by this idea of, you know, destruction to a degree. So risk-taking, if that little bit of psychopathic excitement-seeking is there, the deterrent might be a fun provocation that gives them the energy to do the antisocial thing. So I cannot do this work alone, though. Imagine me doing this in a language I don't know, in a country I don't know, in a military context I don't know. I mean, I'm always doing this closely with analysts, and then it gets to be kind of like that Machiavelli passage, we can make something happen. Callousness or its opposite. Okay, that you really didn't need to know. How they have used deterrence. When have they stepped it up? But more interesting, when have they stepped it down, and what caused them to step it down? Okay. So if we're applying a deterrent and we know that they've done that before and they always have, what made them stop? Because mm-hmm. they'll be projecting that on us,
right.
Okay? But also we can think about what it is in them that made them stop. And you can turn that around and use it in a deterrent. Mm. So, and as always, is the unconscious, okay? Stimulation can come in unconscious. Stimulation can come from being on the receiving end of aggression. And It's not necessarily a negative experience in the moment. You'll hear people been in combat say that war is terrible, and they know it's terrible. They've seen it, but they've never been more alive in the moment. Okay, and it's that never been more alive in the moment that you have to be careful not to stimulate with a deterrent. So that's the best I could do with an area I have less knowledge in.
That's fascinating. I mean, we talk a lot about deterrence theory and policy, the side that we do, the things that we implement. But again, it's about, there's ultimately a leader whose decision you are trying to influence. And, you know, what you've just described gives such valuable insight into the different ways that a leader can react and the importance of understanding where they're coming from and what their experience is. That's a huge part of it. You really need to understand that.
So if you think about Pearl Harbor, we moved our bases, our ships from San Diego, right, to Hawaii as a deterrent. Well, it didn't work, right? Right? And so that was a bit of a mistake and a big mistake. And so that was our mistake. And we were kind of helpless in how we were running things there. I can't get into those details. Mm-hmm. But the Japanese had the idea that, except for a few, obviously, that this tactically brilliant and risky, calculated risk operation would be a deterrent and make us shut down. They didn't understand it would enrage us and that we would turn around our enormous manufacturing capability and make it a war machine. So he had a complete mismatch where in understanding of the other. And so that's a good example. I think of the importance of psychology, but it's a very hard thing to do, and no psychologist should do this alone. You've got to do it with experts. That's a caveat.
So we're talking a lot about awareness of other leaders and setting up leaders, but let's want to turn it around and look inward.
Okay.
My favorite thing to do. Absolutely. Yeah. And I spoke to Annie Boyd, who just retired as the director of the Center for Cyber Intelligence at CIA. Mm-hmm. Did a recording with him about 8 months ago. He told me from his experience doing human intelligence and cyber intelligence that the most important characteristic of a successful intelligence officer is self-awareness, the single most important characteristic. So what psychological tools or tactics or resources can we use, leaders, policymakers, whatever we're doing, to increase our own self-awareness, better understand our own weaknesses and assumptions and biases?
So I'm not really objective on this topic. However, everyone can profit from self-awareness, both professional self-awareness and also personal self-awareness. And we deceive ourselves if we don't think the two come together. Mm. Okay, that's the first thing. So I'll add to his excellent advice is to understand, each person needs to understand how much they don't know about themselves, not what they do know. Because what you do know, you've worked really hard to achieve, and rightly. Your intellectual knowledge, your professional acumen, your teamwork, specific skills like warfighting skills that you have, or cover skills, that you know you have that, and you know to what degree you do. But it's the parts of you that you can't know that are both the power center of your personality and where things go really wrong. So I have a pet peeve, and that is that there's a lot of talk about becoming aware of our unconscious biases. By definition, if it's unconscious, you can't become aware of it, except in extensive psychotherapy. And even then, you're only going to be aware of it in the therapy session. Then you're going to go out and have your life and it'll become unconscious again. Okay. And take it from somebody who's, I have an unconscious. I'm no more aware of it than anyone else. So you have to be aware that and not pressure yourself to dip into something that you really cannot know. Now, this caveat to this, a collective unconscious, okay, is something that we can be in touch with more, because it's where art resides and theater resides. And every time we see a war movie, that's a collective unconscious at play. And oftentimes I fantasize of, let's say I was Italian, since I like Machiavelli, and I was going to be briefing on an American leader of some sort or other. Some of the leaders, and you know who they are, historic leaders, I'd have to begin with the concept of maverick, which is an unbranded member of a herd, horses or cattle, and maverick. Yeah. That's deep in our psyche.
Yeah.
How many movies have you seen where it's the maverick, or we pull together maverick, the Dirty Dozen, whatever. And we like this, and we respond to it unconsciously, for better or for worse. So that's a collective unconscious, and you can be a little more aware of that because we all share it. But what is true to you, you can't really know that except in Freudian slips. Okay, we've all done it, and we all know when we've done it. It's like, where did that come from? I do this too, and dreams. Okay, everybody dreams. It's a royal road to the unconscious and dreams, and in humor. Okay, in humor, the unconscious has been leveraged. Okay, so be aware of that, and it's there, but don't think that you can control it. And the most important thing to do is make sure it has room to bring insight up to you, to express itself in the right times, and then you lock it down and you get on with the business of whatever it is you're doing in a kind of conscious and tactical way or strategic way. So that's what I would say about knowing yourself. It's more knowing that the vast majority of who you are, you can't know like the parts of you that you do know because you haven't honed it. One of the things you could do is go to somebody you trust and really like and tell them this and ask them about it, and they'll tell you things. And a lot of it will be very flattering. You know this, friends. So that's what I would say to what this very interesting kind of know thyself. The solution always is to get a lot of people working on the problem. You probably heard me say in other contexts, I never brief a leader without having an analyst there ever.
Yeah.
Ever. I can do the psyche. Then I stop, and the analyst steps in with the most important part, actually, the policymakers, which is politics, the military, the economics, all the rest, the behavior. To me, politics is just another form of behavior, but of course, to policymakers, politics is bread and butter. And the solution to this is never go solo, never, even if you have to informally consult. And people will correct you. But they also might say, well, that's pretty amazingly interesting. And then off you go. That's why we work on teams.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in combat, does anybody actually win the battle themselves?
No, never.
It's just mind meld, right?
Yeah. That's the bread and butter of the Army. It's an organization completely made of people. Like we were talking about earlier, it's the people that make it so rewarding, and it's the people that ultimately accomplish the mission, and you need those people to work with you. And that applies obviously not just to the Army, but any other organization where you really have to think hard about something.
When you're in that situation, you're in a collective mind, and your unconscious functioning is part of that collective. And that is the solution, I'd say.
Okay. So one more question coming off of that. If a failure to understand yourself does manifest, or how do failures to understand yourself manifest sometimes? What are some mental traps that analysts or experts could fall prey to for us to look out for?
So I am for analysts and leaders, I think I'm to speak of leaders as well. So I in this question. So again, I went and consulted with my husband on this. And so to give you a bit of his, which is what you do, I mean, that's a solution, right? If it's not an arena, I could tell you all about psychologists, but we're talking about analysts now. Mm-hmm. I consulted with my husband, and we had 36 years of service at CIA as an analyst and leader of analysts and analytic programs. And he's now a professor and teaching at another university in town. Okay, I won't mention it because it wouldn't be appropriate when talking about size. But I suspect you know who it is, and he was a PDB editor 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so he listed these things, and then I'll list the psychology of analysis. Okay. So he listed groupthink.
Okay.
And groupthink can be all of you believing that the analytic line is the line of truth and censoring out in yourselves and in others what is saying, hey, wait a minute. That's what Kennedy fell into during Bay of Pigs. The paradox of expertise, you can't really fix that. But the more you know, the more prone you are to thinking you know what's going on, and you're missing the signal. And, you know, you think you know what the signal is, but you're missing it. It's really...
failure of resonation a little bit, too.
Yeah, it's like the more expert you get, the more... Let me give you a quick example from psychology. After you've done a lot of it, when somebody walks through the door, you pretty much get a sense of what the core issue is, or diagnostically, let's say. And it's very dangerous to think that's all there is, because there are many times and that's not what's going on. That's just a superficial presentation. Although there are many times when that is, that's a paradox of expertise. You have to always do the homework. And then the lack of imagination, we've talked about that. And another bias is our current era of history, a bias towards quantification. If you cannot measure it, it does not exist. Mm-hmm. That's what this comes down to. But how do you measure hate? You've been in Kosovo. Mm-hmm. How do you measure the consequences of hate? You can sanitize it into neat little boxes, but in no way it's going to capture the depth and complexity of... You need both, is what I'm saying. So lack of imagination is fed by our current bias towards quantitative methods, which are magical sometimes, but cannot be the be-all and end-all. Projection, and that's simply you're seeing in the other what's in you. Sometimes it's accurate, sometimes not, so you have to check. Now, this one's interesting. Not bringing the right people in to coordinate. Okay, you've coordinated. That can be because you're protecting your analytic line, and you don't want the people who are going to say this is wrong or give you a big battle, so you don't bring them in. But more subtly, you might not be imagining that there might be somebody who has something to say about this.
Sure.
That would be... I can't go into stories too much now, but one of the programs that I did was setting up mental health programs, people embedded in terror groups. And I'd go in and be all these like field-oriented, you know, these are tough. And I always thought it was, okay, fine. And I'd always bring the person I was working with into that dialogue, not any assessment, the dialogue, because I was going to go away. And when the trauma manifested itself, the agent needed somebody to go to. Okay. And then they'd start telling me stories. My colleague would be big eyes. Okay. And they'd hone in. I needed to make myself absent as quickly as possible from that dynamic. But they did not know half the time what the men were enduring there. I did a mini portrait of your average analyst, having been married to one of these youths. So this should not be a surprise, but your average analyst is insatiably curious. Okay, this comes from years of experience looking at applicants, right? Driven to factual truth, seeking for pleasure. Okay, it gives them a kick. All right, that's really important. Sure. And they're the type that will be reading like Locke's two treatises on government on the beach for fun. Okay, it's just kind of... Or Clausewitz on the beach for fun, okay? Yeah. Politics among nations on the beach. They like puzzles for pleasure. And the pleasure part's really important. They have keen pattern recognition, and they're driven to bring order, okay? So there's that. Alongside an ability to spot something that doesn't fit the pattern that should be there. That's a really important piece that goes away in groupthink, okay? They are the custodians of the long view in a crisis. Your analysts are. So everybody's hopping around and dealing with the crisis right now. I got to do this, got to do that. But they're thinking, well, you know, 200 years ago, this happened. And this culture responds this way to that. Or they're thinking, well, 200 years from now, you know. And they're the ones who can bring that broader perspective in from depth knowledge. The hyped up types can't do that. They just want to react. And that's fine. They have their place, but analysts aren't that way. They think because it gives them pleasure, and it's how they embed themselves in reality. And they can hold the line against opposition, but they can also yield. You need both. Okay. So And over all of this, you have highly intelligent people, meaning high abstract reasoning IQ, both numerically as well as verbally. And that is can be present too sometimes, but it's important. That's your analyst. And in terms of what I, as a psychologist, have seen and studied, actually deeply studied this, in regards to pitfalls as well as strengths, and they're actually the pitfalls are the obverse of the strengths. So the strength would be knowing your own role and contributing your knowledge and having a long view when everybody else is focusing on their mission, and it usually isn't the long view. Yeah. But the negative part of this is hubris, the Greek term of, you know, you always reach for more as opposed to being satisfied with what you have. Okay, so intellectual, particularly intellectual hubris. Mm-hmm. The other, you know, the knowing when you're looking at graphic content and horrible things that you have a role, a critical role in preventing it from happening again somewhere, somehow. Okay, you are bringing the power of your mind to bear on such horrible things so that there's a chance that they won't happen again somewhere. They will happen again somewhere, but that they won't happen again somewhere else, okay? Exposure to graphic content is extremely difficult for analysts, and because it doesn't fit that. How can you be curious about graphic content? And yet, for their jobs, they have to be curious about graphic content. They have to study it. Cynicism. You know what cynicism is? It's not realism, okay? Cynicism is hopes that have been crushed. There's a lot of emotion behind cynicism. Yeah. And analysts can get that way. Mm. You got to be careful with that. Now, the positive side of that is reducing the crisis and for people. You're calm, the calm voice in the room. Yeah. Feeling like you're an actor in history is really a credible part of being an analyst, but frustration and helplessness is the other side. And from this comes what I call the Cassandra syndrome, the prophetess of Troy, who was cursed by Adonis because she refused his advances, to always be able to see the truth and speak it, and nobody would believe it. And analysts go through that repetitively. It might be believed by policymakers. It doesn't mean you're going to act on it, but the analyst doesn't really know that. It's happening in the Oval Office. Yeah. So that's the analyst. Hmm. And he also asked me to do this for the leaders. Can I go do that?
Absolutely, please.
Does that follow your flow? Mm-hmm. I want to make sure I'm not getting ahead of myself.
No.
So again, I consulted with my husband on this because he was 5 years at the NSC, four of which were a presidential appointee. Okay, as director of East Asia policy. So he saw a lot of world leaders. Okay. And I said, well, what did you observe? He is married to a psychologist after all, and I think some of it has rubbed off on him. And he said, a leader can think they understand their counterpart because they're on the same profession, and that can be a mistake. So it kind of these immediate fellow feelings, and then turns out to be wrong. He said, sometimes they underestimate or misread the pressures the other leader's under. They're projecting and have to contend with domestically. Every leader has domestic pressures they have to contend to, even the most tyrannical ones. Mm-hmm. A leader can make the mistake of thinking what worked with one leader is going to work with another, especially if they've worked with, say, regionally, so with a leader and it's worked, and they'll say, well, all Asians are this way, or all Americans are this way if you're an Asian leader. And the group factors will help, but the individual personality still is there, okay? And domestically, leaders are in danger of caving to interest groups, okay? In an election cycle, in democracies, that can drive, right? Mm-hmm. And in non-democracies, they still have powerful constituencies like the military that they, and so those are pitfalls, and mm-hmm. that becomes a prison for them. My thought about what is problematic for leaders begins with the bubble. We've all seen the motorcade come through town, right? Put yourself in that motorcade once and think how much fun it would be, okay? You can blowing through traffic, there's all the noise and sounds, people are trying to figure out who it is, even though the windows are tinted. Now do that every time you go anywhere on the ground, okay? Do that for a year, and then leave office. And you're sitting on the beltway in your little car. Okay, the bubble has disappeared.
Yeah.
That's just one aspect of what it's like to be in the bubble. Okay, and so the bubble, Michelle Obama, when she put her children in the car the first day for the Secret Service to drive them to school, her thought was, what are we doing to these babies? They were little kids at that point. That's the bubble.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. A classic ambush technique for reporters to ask, I have some examples here, but to ask a leader, how much does milk cost these days? Have you ever used a credit card? So in 1992, President George H.W. Bush was forced to admit in this ambush technique, okay, how much, that he didn't know how much a gallon of milk cost. Now, I mean, that's kind of silly, but then again, it shows you this man raised kids. Milk's, and then in 2018, the price of eggs went up in Iran, 50%. And the leaders of that country were totally taken aback at the riots around the prices of eggs. Again, they didn't have to worry about where they got their eggs. Mm-hmm. So that's the bubble. There's so much more to that. But yeah. The overuse of charisma, okay, and turning to the dark side, we've already talked about that, yielding. So what a charismatic does is, and it's what artists do, performing artists do, they intuit, they are conscious of the crowd, and they manipulate it. So a performing artist walking on a stage will feel the crowd and then start working it. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so are politicians of this type, for good or for ill. It's a neutral skill. And you can become very seductive to do that, and dangerously so. Although it's a lot of fun, apparently, when you're doing it. Power is addicting and corrupting. And what else is political life but the practice of power? Power is a neutral thing, like secrecy. But being in a place where you no longer have power can be like you almost strip naked, and people do everything they can to avoid that. Because paranoia, there's always a plot if you're a politician, okay? And you have to be really careful not to become paranoid. Impotence and loneliness is very hard. They get all these policies going and then nothing happens, or the opposite happens. Aging, illness, grief. Aging is the one thing that will catch up with you. So about illness and so will grief. And if you have this protean sense of your power, all of a sudden you're stuck. And then legacy obsession. They start with their legacy obsession and they begin to distort things so as not to have the history books of bad things about them. And but eventually history does. And so you just better to just accept that your human fallibilities fallibilities become part of the history. So that's what I would say about leaders.
Well, that's fascinating, Dr. Wilder. Thank you so much for joining us. I wish we could keep on going, keep on talking. It's been truly a treat. And I really appreciate you coming here to SICE to do this with us. And thanks for all your insight. And it's been a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. And I've enjoyed this experience too, Lucas. So thank you for making it such a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on Small World, Big Problems. We hope you found our discussion as fascinating and helpful as I did. If you're interested in more discussion on strategy and security topics, please subscribe to the show on whichever platform you get your podcasts. I'm Luke Lytle, your host, and this has been a production of the Johns Hopkins SICE Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C. We'll see you in a few weeks for the next episode of Small World, Big Problems.